Microsoft Research Connections. Tony has an extensive background with higher education. He was a dean of engineering at the University of Southampton, and he's been associated with higher education for more than 30 years. Today he will be presenting data-intensive research, implications of the fourth paradigm for universities today. I do encourage you to fill out your session evaluation forms and to help me welcome Tony to this presentation.
Hi, yes, it's a great pleasure to be here. Last EDUCAUSE meeting I was at was in Australia. Okay, so a few words about Microsoft Research. This is the mission statement we've had for 20 years. This year we celebrated our 20-year anniversary, and it's been the same for 20 years. Expand the state of the art in the areas we do research. We do technology transfer, obviously, and it's really very gratifying as a computer scientist to see the things that you do actually end up in products for millions across the world. And, of course, we have to ensure or help ensure that Microsoft does have a future in the rapidly changing world. Microsoft Research is about 800 PhD computer science researchers, and they're in labs around the world. The major lab is at Redmond, where I'm based, in near Seattle, but there's labs in Europe, in Asia, India, and a few other places. We're also doing a partnership with Partners in Learning. This is a program that's been going on for the last 10 years in Microsoft. It's another team in Microsoft, and they've been working for 10 years through K-12, and now they're extending their activities to higher education. And Microsoft Research will be partnering them in their higher education activities, where they're going to actually focus on academic summits for senior university leaders, a teacher education initiative jointly with faculty to find out what works, what doesn't work in the technology, in teaching, and also a social networking environment with the Higher Education Consortium. So you can find out more about that at the Microsoft stand in the exhibition. This is what my group does. My group is charged with working with the universities, if you like, it's external research collaboration, so it's typically matching a university research activity with a Microsoft research activity, both in computer science, but also in science, trying to apply computer science technologies to solve some of the problems of the world in healthcare and environment and so on. So we have a global program, which I'll give you a few examples today. So the outline of the talk is this, in case you get lost, and I'll make available, if anybody wants a copy of the slides, they can pick them up at the Microsoft stand afterwards. So if I go too fast, you can actually use that if you want. Talk about the data deluge, then about some examples of data-intensive research, supporting the whole of the data life cycle. And then I think an important issue for universities is the issue of research libraries and institutional repositories. I'll talk a little bit about virtual research environments and the cloud before making some conclusions. So the first thing, just to, for those of you who may not have been following things, there is at the moment a tidal wave of scientific data. We're going to collect in the next 5 years more scientific data than the world has collected up to now. And so it's really going to overwhelm scientists unless we can give them better tools to manage, organize, and analyze that data. My colleague Jim Gray, who alas died a few years ago, lost at sea, talked about a fourth paradigm. So we all know that experimental science has been done since the Egyptians and the Greeks, and in the last few hundred years we've understood you can encapsulate that in laws of nature, things like Newton's laws, Maxwell's equations, the Schrodinger equation, and so on. And so those have been the traditional ways of exploring scientific phenomena, the theory and experiment, and you can make predictions and then do experiments. But in the last 50 years, computers have come along and enabled us to do different types of exploration. It isn't the same, it doesn't displace the first two, but computational science was called by Ken Wilson a third paradigm for doing science, because you can do things like climate change simulations, you can do things like simulating the birth of galaxies, black hole collisions and so on, things that you can't do experimentally. And today we're seeing, because of this deluge of data coming from high-throughput sequencing instruments, you know, it took 10 years or more to do a single human genome. Now we're going to do, you know, hundreds of human genomes on a routine basis, and soon we'll all be able to have our genes sequenced at a nominal price. We also, supercomputers generate huge amounts of data from their simulations, and of course we're now seeing sensor networks everywhere, satellite surveys, large amounts of data. And in the UK, I ran what was called the UK eScience Initiative, which was about trying to get a set of technologies that will help scientists deal with this typical distributed, collaborative, data-intensive world. And that's what eScience means to me, a set of technologies to help scientists do their work. This is another slide from Jim Gray's last presentation. He talked about X-informatics. So a given field X, like biology, you're now seeing the emergence of computational biology, but also bioinformatics. Similarly in chemistry, computational chemistry, chemoinformatics. And to do this, you need a whole different set of skills. For doing computational science, you need to know about algorithms, numerical methods, computer architectures, parallel programming languages. For these, you need to know about all sorts of data management issues, like things like annotations, metadata, schemas, how you organize a petabyte, how you reorganize it, how you share it, how you visualize it, and so on. A different set of skills. And besides, you know, biology and chemistry, you also see things now like astroinformatics and archaeoinformatics, where this technology is actually becoming pervasive. We're actually having a lot of digital data. In this case, in archaeology, you have physical artifacts, but you also have reconstructions and simulations and so on. And putting that together is the field, if you like, of archaeoinformatics. We produced a book called The Fourth Paradigm, which was it's available under a Creative Commons license. And what it was scientists and computer scientists giving their vision of the future. What will it look like 5 years from now? So we looked at environment, we looked at healthcare, we also looked at scientific infrastructure that will be needed, and also the implications for libraries. So those of you who would like to look at that, it's available on the website, free download, or you can get a version for your Kindle. There are also some other information you might find interesting from the Office of Cyber Infrastructure in NSF. I was a member of the Advisory Committee for Cyber Infrastructure, and they were tasked with, they created a number of task forces which talked about a number of issues for the cyber infrastructure to support this data-intensive world. And these are things you might find worth looking at. I was involved with the one on data and visualization. So, that's the background. What about some examples? Well, what we're doing with Microsoft Research, we have some wonderful machine learning researchers in Microsoft Research, and now we're working with healthcare professionals and biologists to look at how we can actually analyze the genetic data that they get to see if we can do something about diseases like HIV and AIDS, diseases like asthma and diabetes, and trying to identify with the researcher how you can actually produce a vaccine, how you can produce some sort of drug to actually block the actual effects of that disease. And we're also looking at genetic things for sugarcane in Brazil, for example. The cars there run on ethanol and they grow sugarcane, but if you could do it more efficiently, that would have a major effect, and maybe you could grow sugarcane in other parts of the world. So those are some of the projects that we're doing using computer science technologies, which were, you know, designed to get into Microsoft's product line, but also using them also to do some things in science. Another example is the NSF Ocean Observatory Initiative. There they're actually putting hundreds of cables and things. So I live in Seattle, so it seems like a very good idea to put to instrument the earthquake plate going underneath Seattle, and that's what they're doing here. And so they have all sorts of sensors and robots and video feeds coming in. So instead of getting data from a ship on the surface every now and then, here you're going to get data coming in from this network on the seabed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And the field is going from being data poor, just getting data every now and then, to having huge amounts of data coming in every day. And so how one deals with that is going to be a major issue. You'll also need new tools to look at this data, and this is just one tool, how you can zoom through huge amounts of astronomy data, how you can look at them in new ways, how you can compare the infrared with the ultraviolet, with the visible, and so on. And so this is a tool that enables you to do that. And I think you'll need lots of other tools to do that. I talked about eScience, that was the name of the initiative in the UK, but actually in Australia they thought about what they should call a similar initiative, and they called it eResearch, because as I said, with archaeology and other humanities disciplines, there are now vast amounts of digital information created along with physical artifacts. And so this is an interesting example at Brown University with Andy Van Dam. What you see there is what's called the Garibaldi Panorama. It's a scroll which is, you know, nearly the length of a football field. It's 5 feet tall. And what they used to do was give a movie sort of thing hundreds of years ago where they used to unroll it and talk about it as it went on in for example, a venue like this. How do you show such a thing if you're in a museum nowadays? You don't want it to be destroyed by too much exposure, and one way of doing it is actually digitizing it and putting it on, as you see here, a surface that you can play with, but you can also put it on a screen, you can zoom in, you can zoom out. And so these are the sort of things that we've been doing with the Harvard Smithsonian and the British Library with Brown on technologies like the surface to actually go and make such artifacts visible. This is another challenge. It's called Big History, the Big History Agenda. Walter Alvarez in Berkeley was he and his father came up with the theory about the death of the dinosaurs, and it's a wonderful multidisciplinary story. You needed to know all sorts of geology, you needed to know metallurgy, you needed to know all sorts of different parts of science in order to piece together the puzzle. And so what Walter is trying to do is to look and see how you can put together different types of information at different scales. So let me see if I can demonstrate that by going to their website here. Okay, so this is an example of what we call the tool ChronoZoom. We've worked with them to develop. And here you see a plot of gigantic timescales here, billions of years up to the present, from the Big Bang over here right up to the present. And you can put all sorts of different types of data on here. You can put the origin of the planets. You can put the origin of the beginnings of life here. This is the beginning of life right up to where we live now. And how do you actually see those things? Well, you can actually zoom in with this tool, so you can go right down to the Big Bang, which is where you can actually put data and analyze that data in the appropriate depth, go back to the holes that are cosmic history, and you can go and see where the origin of the Earth and the planets, that's this piece, and you can also go and see human prehistory, which is up this piece here. And then if you're interested about us, you can go to this bit. Okay, so it's how you can deal with this, and you can see, look, that's going away, and that's where we are on this time scale. So how can you, this is just one example applied to astronomy, but we're looking at other examples in other areas of science. Okay, so let's go back to the presentation. So new tools to go and visualize this data, how will you, and it's not just science data, it's also arts and humanities data. I don't have time to go and do more examples here. supporting the data life cycle. So data is central to everything, so it starts off with acquisition or the simulations of generating data, how you curate it, how you actually clean it, how you make sure that you've actually documented it adequately. Then it may involve collaboration, sharing, combining data, visualizing it, analysis and data mining to get insight. And then you want to publish and share it. And finally, you want to archive and save some of that data. You may want to link it to your publication. So there's a whole set of activities here. And what we've been doing in Microsoft is trying to see if we can enhance some of the tools that we produce, working with the scientists to help them make their lives easier. So here is, from the publication phase, an authoring add-in. So if you're working with the National Library of Medicine, they like a specific XML DTD, and this is help you do that, working with the publishers, how you can actually specify your document and add XML tags to it. You can also do chemical equations. This looks trivial, chemical equations in Word. Well, it's a little more than that because it's actually used as the chemical markup language. So when you type in CH4, the computer has enough knowledge to know that the C is a carbon atom and the H4 are four hydrogens. So it can give you the choice of calling that methane, CH4, or giving you the chemical structure. So it's the beginning, if you like, of semantic chemistry. So that's a tool that we've been playing with chemists. And then for social networking, this is another add-in. It's a different type of Excel has many, many displays, but it doesn't have something for exploring networks. And this is how you could do social networks. Had I had time, I would have looked at the tags for this conference and actually looked at the Twitter feeds, and we could have done an analysis of the audience of this conference, for example, and see who the connectors are, who are the people receiving, who are the networks that exist. And finally, with the California Digital Library, we're doing a data curation add-in, which has it's in its early stages, but things like versioning, timestamps, standard formats for metadata, shared vocabulary and annotations and so on. So these are the sort of things that we might include in that, but again, we're working with the users and really wish to produce something that's useful for them going forward. And finally, out in the world, there are billions of Word documents and WordPerfect. Some of you will remember WordPerfect. It was a good thing. But it didn't quite make the transitions quickly to the GUI world, and so actually it lost out to Word. But how you can get those documents, which are sort of sitting there becoming more and more inaccessible, how you can get them to a modern XML format. And it doesn't really matter which format, whether it's OpenXML, which enables you to preserve the sort of the look and feel of the document, or you can do an ODF, which is the open document format. Both are ISO standards. You can go from one to the other. So this was a European Union project where we had produced converters to go from old formats to an XML format. There's an open source tool to go from OpenXML to ODF or ODF to OpenXML. So you have the choice. You control your data. We're also working with an open source foundation called the Outer Curve Foundation, which is attempting to be license neutral, any open source license. It can use any forge you like, but it makes it very easy for companies to contribute to the open source software in there without actually violating any of their company intellectual property and so on. So this is actually very helpful for my staff to be able to contribute to these projects. We have a workflow tool, chemistry add-in I talked about, conferencing tool, and we've just released a sort of bioinformatics tool. There's a thing called BioJava, BioRuby, BioPerl. This is, if you like, .NET version of that. So it enables you to do the sort of things that it's a toolkit for people doing biology. Research libraries and repositories. So this this was a headline from 2007, University of Michigan cancelling some journal subscriptions because of budget cuts. 2,500 were cancelled that year. The university library budget has gone up an average of 3% since 2004, and the average subscription since 2003 of humanities Journal 6.8, Social Science 9.2, Science Journals 8.3. This is just a snapshot. I mean, this has been true for the last 10 years or more. So there's a problem with actual journals that the typical academic doesn't necessarily see, but there really is a real problem. And this is another one from 2010. They've had budget cuts at San Diego. They're cancelling 500 titles here. The state funding for the libraries has gone down by 20%. But again, the journal prices will increase nationally in 2012 by, you know, between 6% and 8%. You can do these big deals. The big deals are negotiated by librarians. So if I want, I'm a researcher and I'm doing research on salmon, what the deals do, you don't get just the journals on salmon, you also get sardines and pilchards and mackerel and things. Actually, I want the salmon data, not the other ones, but we have these deals. But they do actually slow the cost increases to 3 to 5%. But with a 20% cut, that's still unsustainable for UCD. So as Dean of Engineering at Southampton, I was supposed to be, in some sense, responsible for monitoring the research output of over 200 faculty and 500 postdocs and students. Each year I got a piece of paper from the university librarian, very nice of him, saying, which journals do you want to cancel? All right. So I edit a journal. The university library in my university didn't take that journal, even though it was central for my research group. So since I was supposed to keep track of this, and the university couldn't afford to subscribe to all the journals they publish in, what we did was to insist that we keep a digital copy of everything they produce, the research papers, but also the conference papers, also the reports and so on. And what that led to was the establishment at Southampton of a university repository, and also eventually to the idea of a university mandate that because you're going to get your promotion assessed, you have to have your papers in the university repository. So that's what we did at Southampton. There's been some talks at this conference from Hal Abelson yesterday and from Malcolm Reed this morning about openness and the importance of openness, which is something I subscribe to. So green open access or self-archiving is actually just when you submit a paper, you have two buttons. You send it off to your favorite journal. You also have a button that goes into your university repository. All right? And that's what we should have, and that's what we tried to build at Southampton. And what you put in there are not necessarily the final version, because publishers won't let you do that, but most publishers allow you to keep a version. And so you can actually have content, the full text of a version of your paper, up on the university repository. Usually that can be available to people outside the university. On a few occasions, depending on the journal, it has to be restricted. But that's what you can do yourselves. There's nothing stopping you doing that now, and why should you want to do it? Well, this is an example from Virginia Tech, who in 1997 put all their theses and dissertations online. And in 1997, they had 200,000 requests. Less than 10 years later, they had 20 million requests for these. I find that extraordinary, but it shows you what the power of making this available can do. And so in the same vein, we all hear now about league tables. I was in the UK and we were ranked, every university department was ranked every 5 years, depending on the publications and citations and all sorts of other indicators. So you can build your own tables. Here is one that's done by this group called Webometrics in Spain. And they produce a ranking of universities with combining four different things. Now, I'm not actually advocating that this is a sensible thing to do, right? But this is what this group do. So they have visibility. So is your site visible, internal links? They have the size, the number of web pages, which doesn't seem to me such a sensible thing to worry about. And then the amount of volume in PDF, doc, PowerPoint, and so on that you have on your site. And again, that not seems to me necessarily what you want to measure. But it also looks at the number of papers and the citations you have according to Google Scholar. And so these are the weights they give. And if you go and look at the table that they produce, it gives you something not very surprising. These are the top 25 universities worldwide according to Webometrics, and you will see it's North America all the way until number 23, which is the University of Cambridge in England. And, you know, it's no surprises, Harvard, MIT, Stanford, Berkeley, Cornell, exactly the sort of things you'd expect. Some surprises to me, Minnesota at number 8, I don't know why that is, but what I'm going to do is look at their data. I did this in July last summer, I haven't updated it, and just look at the last column. So I'm only looking at one of their criteria, which is the number of papers and the citations. And if you rank the universities according to that, you get this table. Harvard, MIT are at the top again, but then the university in Mexico, UNAM, comes third. Minnesota, amazingly, comes fourth. And then Stanford, but Cornell down the bottom. But there's a lot of other major universities, research universities, that don't appear there. And because in Southampton we have a policy of making our research available, visible, we come at 21. According to this ranking, we're more relevant than Cambridge and Oxford, which I can assure you in the UK is not the case. Right? And Virginia Tech, also number 37. So, but what I want to make the point is that people, whether or not you like this particular league table, people will do league tables. This is not a perfect metric, but no one can argue if you wish to be taken seriously as a research university, people should be reading your papers. And this is a measure of how much they're reading your papers. And I do think that institutional research repositories actually are part of the university's reputation management, that you really need to be up there. So, you know, Minnesota's obviously doing a great job. Okay, so that's what I believe the importance of institutional repositories, and I also believe open access will come. And with the web, we don't necessarily need to be restricted to the printing presses. We can disseminate. So I think it's a matter of time, but change will come. What about the future of them? Well, I think we talked about publications, full text of publications, but also in the future they'll contain grey literature, workshop papers, presentations, theses, and so on. But in addition, they'll contain software, images, and some, I believe, will contain data, because when you're doing we had a project at Southampton, again, with the National Oceanographic Centre, and some of their data for oceanography is stored nationally in a national repository, but they produce lots of other data which supports some of their other papers. What do you do with that? How do you keep it? How do you make other people be able to go and check the provenance of that research result? So actually, I think universities do have a responsibility, and university libraries actually have a responsibility for looking after the intellectual output of the university, which includes data. So let me just give examples, a few examples. There are ways to do this for a given subject. You have things like Archive for Physics, which is a centralized one, and National Library of Medicine for biomedical information, which is a centralized database. But other fields will not be so fortunate to be funded in that way, and you'll have distributed things in repositories and have to search across repositories. So National Library of Medicine have PubMed Central, where now there's a law signed into effect by George Bush, which actually mandates if you're funded by the NIH, you have to put your paper, full text, into PubMed Central within a year. So it can be published in Science and Nature, but within a year, they have to put the full text version into PubMed Central. And they also now have a tool which realizes this vision I was talking about the data and the publications. It's called Entrée. It's a wonderful cross-database tool, and you can go from the PubMed abstracts, PubMed Central full text, you can go to the data the thing's based on, to another data set, to another paper. You can do searches in this way across a whole range of databases. And that's, I think, where we need to be going in the future. But ours is a distributed world in most fields. So this is an organization called worldwidescience.org. It's got 65 nations now, 400 million pages, has some well-known sources. It also has some rather less well-known sources. And what it does, it makes it available that you can go and access this, and so Microsoft Research was involved with the translation tool. So you can query, if you like, put your query in. It goes and looks at the database in China and translates your query into Chinese, gets the answer, translates the result back. And so that's what this translation service does. And it's interesting because not all these resources are available in HTML and HTTP sites, so they're not all available to the World Wide Web. And this is a slide from Walt Wernick of the Office of Science and Technical Information at DOE. They did a search comparing what Google got and what their federated search engine got across these resources. And only 3.5% were found by Google, in this case, and the rest of their distributed search engines saw resources that a normal search engine would not see, Google or Bing or whatever. Right? So interesting things. I call this the invisible web. It was, in fact, the topic of my wife's PhD thesis. And then in Europe, there's been a lot of activity, I think simulated by the work of JISC and the work of CERF in the Netherlands. And this is the European Union. They have a coalition of open access repositories. So there are many universities now trying to work together to see if they can come up with standards to make a sort of federation of institutional repositories, a resource that you can search and trust. It's interesting to me that very few US universities are involved in this effort, and it does seem to me that it's a worthwhile effort, and really research is global, so it really would be worth having a look at this. So I just mentioned that as something you should do. One of the other tools we're looking at is, when you've got your repository, how can you search it, how can you make it more valuable? This is actually adding some semantic information, like semantic triples, like RDF, for example. This uses the entity framework, which is very similar. And it allows you to classify your data. So we've done it with the Economic and Social Research Council in the UK. They've been able to look at their grants, and you can analyze them and view them in various ways because of the semantic information we've added, and also the university in Bogota in Colombia. So those might be of interest. So virtual computing research environments and search. Well, in the UK, the JISC has been supporting initiatives on what are called VREs there, virtual research environments. And I spent my life for 5 years trying to build a UK e-science initiative entirely an open source. And the conclusion I came to, which is one of the reasons I joined Microsoft, was really that we funded enormous numbers of open source projects. And I would say well over 90% of them, when the postdoc left or the student finished, just died. They did interesting things, but it didn't actually get sustained. And so I came to the conclusion, I set up a thing called the Open Middleware Initiative, which was Open Middleware Institute, whose job was to take good open source projects and do the testing and documentation to make it more usable. So we picked out a few of the most popular ones to try and make them sustainable. But it's a very expensive process. So it seems to me that now that budgets for education around the globe are diminishing, that actually you need to spend your money wisely. So I do believe that if you can get it from Oracle or IBM or Microsoft, a piece of what you need, then put open source around it, that's a really much more sustainable way. Why develop the underlying things and having an army of people to go and develop it? One of the first things I did was head of department of my Department of Electronics and Computer Science. We had our homegrown, it was in the early days of the web, we had our homegrown browser and email system. And I had an army of people whose job it was to support that software. And then if I wanted anything changed, they'd tell me it was impossible, it would take 12 months or whatever. So in the end, I cancelled it, and we bought what we actually use, Eudora. All right? And I was able to take those people and put them onto more useful things. And I think we need to have a sort of mixed strategy where you have some commercial, some open source. Yes, they have to be interoperable, and you have to give academics a choice. But that's my personal view. So this is what we're doing with SharePoint, using that as a virtual research environment to to give access for the researcher, the projects, all the sort of things they need to know, the social networks, the blogs, the wikis, and so on. So this is building around a commercial tool which actually, you know, the IT departments know how to support. And especially when you have a SharePoint now in the cloud, it becomes much easier for research groups to go and manage and run such a site. When you've got all this, you want to be able to search it. So this is now a research project. It's not ready. It says beta. Remember there, we're not arguing that this is actually ready for prime time yet. But I just thought I'd tell you a little bit about it. We're trying to do an academic search tool, which is slightly different from Google Scholar. What we're trying to do, initially we started with computer science, and now we're trying to actually expand the functionality. And it can do all the sort of things that academics like to do, top papers, top researchers, and so on. And it comes from crawling open access repositories, negotiations with publishers to get all their data in, and web crawling all of that. Currently, we're in the middle. We've got about 37 million papers across 20 domains. We have permission to get to 150 million, but we've got to go and index that and do some work on that. So it's not ready, and if you use it now, and I invite you to try it, you may find that not all your papers are there. So wait, we're not ready yet. But if you do this, you can look at things like this, for example. Now, I've carefully chosen the last 5 years for the top 10 computer science organizations because that shows that Microsoft Research is top, all right? If I'd chosen all years, we would not be top. So people will use this to create whatever they like in terms of league tables. And what we'd like to do is give you the power to use the same data to produce whatever rankings you want for your university, for your country, whatever. So you can do this. And so this is something you can do for an academic. This is Carl Lugosi. You can look at his papers, publications, look who he collaborates with. Nice little tools there. But what we're doing is publishing an API. So you can actually go and write your own application, and you can build the clients that are useful to you, and this is something that we hope will be used. So this is down in the University of Washington. There's a group called eigenfactor.org, which have taken this API and built a number of services on it. And they have some very interesting services. Rank looks at not just citations, but it's sort of like PageRank. For publications, and it gives you a different ranking of significance of papers. So you can build whatever tools you want, and so that's what we would like. We would like feedback from you. What would you like to build? Do you need some help, and so on? We'd like to make this a tool that people find useful, and we'd also like to include data in there. Okay, cloud computing. Okay, so everybody has their own definition of cloud computing. I often show the NIST definition. But what Microsoft is talking about clouds, it's talking about built on big data centers where there are real economies of scale. So we have 100 globally distributed data centers, major ones, Quincy, Washington, Chicago, San Antonio in the US, and so on. In Europe, we have Amsterdam and Dublin, Singapore in the Far East, and so on. But because we don't have them everywhere, we also have smaller ones, which are called edge servers. You also have to have high bandwidth connections, which is what these are showing, very high bandwidth in and out of the data centers. So that's the sort of infrastructure that Google and Amazon and Microsoft and others have had to build for this type of cloud services. Large amounts. Each one contains, 100,000 to a million servers. And the purpose-built containers, the whole a Chicago data center cost $500 million. It's about 10 football fields in area. These containers, you can just park them. So I could take one, park them outside the convention center. It has three sockets, power, bandwidth, and cooling. And off you have your own data center sitting in the car park outside this building. So you can put a lot of stuff in. The Green Grid Consortium are looking at energy efficiencies. A lot of energy is used by IT, and they talk about a power usage effectiveness, which is basically the amount of power in to a data center and the amount of power actually divided by the amount of power actually used to do the computing and storage. And because we'd been doing designs, our latest designs with air cooling, that's what that meant to show, clever types of air cooling, if it's warmer outside, if it's colder outside, it does all these adjustments. You get down to an efficiency of 1.2 or so, compared to over 1.5, sometimes over 2 for most of the other types of data centers. So you get big savings of that. You get big savings in people time, that you don't need so many administrators to manage 1,000 workstations and so on. So that's the reason why data centers, from these big data centers, can give you real savings. They're real savings in we put ours next to a hydroelectric plant, so we get cheap electric power and so on. And therefore, because we can make some money, you can make some savings because there's a big cost reduction. Many options. You can have a public cloud, dedicated cloud, private cloud. You can do it with your internal IT. So there are all sorts of options and configurations, mix and match, and that's a choice for universities to make. But I do think clouds of some sort will be in your future. So we've been looking at cloud computing for research, and we've been looking at partnerships with the NSF, with the European Union, and also in Japan. So this is just one example that my team did, looking at NASA's MODIS satellite, doing a complicated calculation from the individual photographs taken by the satellite. You have to put them all together, you have to do some analysis, and so on. And so all these stages, data collection, reprojection, reduction, and then they produce something that a scientist could use. So it has to go through all these stages first. And we costed exactly what it costs, how much upload, how much storage, how much calculation. And it turns out to do a year's worth of data cost you about $1,400. That's fairly cheap compared to a grad student, right? But on the other hand, if you've got a dedicated cluster, maybe it's cheaper to do it that way. If you've got, you know, so I think you're going to have to look at these figures for yourself, but these are just some early examples that we've been looking at. Again, in the European Union, we have this project called VenusC, virtual multidisciplinary environments using cloud infrastructures, looking at interoperability of clouds, because you don't want to be tied in necessarily to Microsoft's cloud. You really might want the option to switching to Amazon's or somebody else's. And so they're looking at a whole lot of pilot scenarios in all sorts of areas for applications, understanding the trade-offs, where when it's worthwhile, when it's not worthwhile. And so this is an example we did with, remember the fires in Greece some years ago. This is on an island in Greece where they have linked up all the different resources, satellites, emergency services, and using the cloud they can link these together so they can actually see which areas are likely to be at risk and then take preventative action. So this is something that we have a pilot that we've developed with the Greek services. What about the future? Well, okay, so one of the things in the future I think will be natural user interfaces, or NUIs, all right? Talked about GUIs before, these are NUIs. And there are all sorts of ways. You see some things here. One of the things, you can have a keyboard on your hand and you can just actually make it work in the usual way, using the body as an input device. And the obvious thing that we've been looking at is Kinect, an infrared camera, which gives you depth information as well as an ordinary camera. And so what people can do about this, all sorts of things. You can do the Tom Cruise sort of thing that he did in Minority Report. So what we've been doing is working with we have a Kinect for Windows software development kit, which you can all use, your students, your faculty can go and play with, and develop applications. So what I'll show you is a short video which actually shows some of the applications. It doesn't show, in my view, the most sensible applications, because you can imagine if you're a doctor in an operating theatre, you don't want to take your gloves off to touch the computer. You want to be able to speak to it or gesture to it or whatever. And so these things have serious applications. But let me show you this video anyway, all right?
42.
Told you they weren't very sensible, right? But it does show you what you can do, and I think Microsoft's learning to work with the community, to experiment, to have fun, to see if we can come up with some really applications that can do good things. You saw it controlling a chair for an invalid and so on. So many serious applications along with fun ones. So I think people can play. The second technology that I think is going to be important is what I call semantic computing. I call it semantic computing as opposed to semantic web, because semantic web means a specific set of technologies like ontologies, RDF, OWL, and all that sort of stuff. And that may have a piece, but it isn't the only piece. I think the things like machine learning, where you can use Bayesian networks to do inference and so on, are also a piece of what I would call semantic computing. So computers at the moment do great for storing, managing, computing, and indexing lots of data. Google and Microsoft index the web, for example. But what we will need in the future, something like 2 papers a minute, the abstracts are deposited in PubMed. 2 papers a minute throughout the year. There is no way you can keep up with that. You need to have some filter. You need to have it automated. You need computers to be acting on your behalf to actually get the information they know that you want. So you have to have intelligent, you have to have machine-readable pages. So one of the developments recently is that Yahoo, Google, and Microsoft have teamed up to produce a common vocabulary called schema.org. So if I'm looking, for example, for Casablanca, it knows that I'm looking for the movie, not the place. And you can actually put in the website some micro formats which says this is the movie or this is a place. And so the computer can recognize that site's relevant, that's not. So the beginnings of semantic computing are coming. And I think that's going to be more and more important in the future as we get submerged by this information overload. Right. Acquisition, aggregation, correlation, interpretation, discovery, organization, analysis, and inference. That's what you need help, and that's what computers need to be able to do. And lastly, there was a movie, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. Well, okay, Cloudy with a Chance of Semantics. I think that you'll have a mixture of things. You'll have a mixture of open source and closed source. You'll have a mixture of client and cloud. And you'll have, for example, compute services and storage services up in the cloud, yes, but also identity services, blogging and stuff. You know all about those. But you'll keep some of the data locally. You may keep a local copy and keep a copy in the cloud. So I think a judicious mixture of cloud and client will be in the future. It'll depend whether you're teaching, whether you're doing research, what type of research you're doing, what the costs are. But, you know, the typical researcher, as I used to run a research group, first of all, you know, grad students are cheap to run. They all require pizza and Coke, all right? And secondly, one of them's your system programmer, all right? So you don't need to worry about updating the machine because the grad student does it. And what about electricity? Oh, that comes free from the university, and space and all this sort of stuff. So universities, in my experience, are not very good on things like total cost of ownership, all right? And that's why you have to compare that with the costs of commercial services. And it's a difficult trade-off. And I think, you know, we'll have to explore what happens. But I do believe that semantic computing, NUIs, and clouds will be in your future. Thank you very much for listening. I think there may be time for one or two questions if there are any. But if people want a copy of these slides, you can go to the Microsoft booth, and I've left a copy there. You can download a copy onto your USB stick if you want. I think it's time for the coffee break. Thanks very much, guys.